everybody. Welcome to episode 130 of the Alexcel podcast. And this is, I've been looking forward to interviewing my guest for quite a while, really. Her name's Molly Crabapple, and she's written a book called Here Where We Live Is Our Country, which is the story of the Jewish Bund. I'll just make a couple of observations first. My publishers recently did a big biography by a guy called Anthony Beevor, who did a big biography of Rasputin, and meticulously researched, I presume got into the, I don't know when he got into the archives, whatever, but and yet at the end of it, really, while you know what happened, you don't know any more about why those people did what they, did what they did, really. And one of the artistic leaps that you make is that you go into the heads, I think, of your protagonists and take a chance in a way of, obviously, again, based on meticulous research, but based on what you think they were thinking, really. And that, I think that brings it alive, brings history alive, really, in a way that something like, these mighty tomes of historical writing don't, really. So it's also a personal journey for you. And so there's that element to it, really. So, I guess I'll just let you talk and say there's the story of your, it's kind of centered around your great-grandfather, Sam Rothbart.
Right, a painter and someone who I grew up entirely surrounded by, like through his paintings, through his poems, his sculptures, and through the stories about him.
I mean, one slight frustration is that there are no examples of his work in the book, aren't there, for whatever reason, which I think is, one would like to see them, really. So
I wished I could have done it, but he was a post-impressionist painter who did these gorgeous watercolors, but they're the type of watercolors that if you made them black and white, they would look like dreck. And so my publisher, right, being stingy as publishers are these days, was not going to reproduce them with colored plates.
Called color, right. Shame. Well, maybe at some point we'll get to see examples of those. But just tell us really about how your experience of living surrounded by his work led you on a journey to want to write about the other great theme of intellectual thought in Jewish life in the 19th century, 20th century, which is the Bund, Jewish socialism, rather than, an ideology of fraternity and cooperation rather than Zionism, which is the ideology of racial supremacy.
Well, I grew up in a home full of leftists and of artists. My mother's an artist. She taught me how to paint. And she learned how to paint from my great-grandfather, Sam Rothbart. She was someone who grew up immersed in that world that was both passionately devoted to art, but also passionately believed in human equality. My great-grandfather, he was someone who, the only division I think that he would draw between people were whether or not you were a painter or whether you weren't. And one of the bodies of work that my great-grandfather Sam had were these 600 and some odd watercolors that he called memory paintings. And these were paintings of the small town Volkovysk that he came from in the Tsarist Empire, a town that he left under shady circumstances in 1904. And they were every aspect of life. They were him being a bad boy, teaching the other kids in religious school how to smoke, or trying to eat fire to impress the little girls. They were the market days, the quotidian violence, the soldiers, the glorious nature of chalk hills and blue lakes from where he came from. But there was one painting that I loved since I was a little girl. And it was a young woman, the long skirt, her hair in an updo, a 19th century woman. And she was standing on some miserable dirt road, and she was throwing a rock through a window. And next to her was her boyfriend offering more rocks. And this painting, which was titled Itka the Bundist, was something that blew my mind when I was young, because it was so different than I imagined a young Jewish woman in the Tsarist Empire at the dawn of the 20th century would be. And I imagined the secret to why it was so different had to be in that word, Bundist. And I would ask myself, Bundist, what was that? And it was really that question, a question I asked myself a long time ago, that set me on this path to write this book about the Jewish labor Bund and about my great-grandfather.
So I think, I mean, what's exciting about this book is obviously it comes from a different place than the kind of dry historicism, but also it is, goes back and evokes and makes explicit and brings back to life, several strains of political thought that have been deliberately suppressed, really, which is one, the history of the Bund, the history of socialism amongst Jews in Eastern Central Europe, and also, of course, I mean, later on, the history of the radicalism in the United States as well. I mean, did you feel compelled? I mean, what was your compulsion to really write about this Bundist whose picture you saw?
I mean, I think it's very much a moment that this story needed to be told. And I feel a strange sort of luck that I started writing this 7 years ago, and yet it arrived at the moment when it was most needed, when Jewish people most need to assert their rejection of the violent supremacist ideology of Zionism and most need to find other more liberatory histories. So I'm incredibly grateful that I started this so long ago and that it's coming out now. Now, I think the spark that led me to decide to do serious work about the Bund and not just, you know, have it as a family curio was I went to Palestine in 2015 as a guest of the Palestine Festival of Literature. And after the festival was done, after I had presented Ramallah, I was able to get a press pass and go to Gaza. And I reported from Gaza for Vice, where I was a contributing editor. And anyone who has ever been to Gaza knows the intense, claustrophobic violence of the siege, right? They know the sound of the drones buzzing above people. They know what the horizon line of the sea looks like when it's blighted by warships. They know the landscape that now has been erased and decimated by Israeli bombs, but then was merely blighted and cratered with it. And they feel rage with it, right? Because that when you're a morally normal person and you see those sort of crimes being done to any people, let alone people as tough and funny and cool as people in Gaza are, when you're a morally normal person, you see that, you get disgusted at the people doing those crimes, right? And you get disgusted at the ideology that led to those crimes. And so after I returned from Palestine, I was horrified. I was horrified at the Israeli state. I was horrified at the Zionist ideology. And when it was maybe a year later, I was doing one of those nerd vices that I think many of your listeners probably have, which is that I was getting drunk and looking on Wikipedia and reading it aloud to my poor, long-suffering boyfriend. And I was reading about the Bund because I had heard about it from this watercolor, just, you know, the way that I would read about all sorts of leftist things. And that night, I realized two things. One was that the Bund was there for every single critical juncture of the 20th century in Eastern Europe, from the Russian Revolution to the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And the second is that I learned it was anti-Zionist. And those two things clicked in me, and I was like, why is it that this movement, this very important Jewish movement that was there for all of these major historical turning points, why is it that something that so few people know about? And the answer seemed to me to be that it was anti-Zionist. And so I got a bit obsessed, and I did lunatic amounts of research. I read every book I could in all the languages I knew, which is at that time English, Spanish, and French. And I wrote an article for the New York Review of Books that was about the Bund and about my bohemian leftist great-grandfather. And it was the most viral thing I'd ever written. It came out in 2018. Thousands of people wrote to me about it. And especially elderly people from Bundist families got in touch with me. These are people like the great lesbian poet, Irena Klepfitsch, or the great labor leader, Mark Ehrlich. And they told me these amazing stories about their families. Irena's dad, he was the head bomb maker for the Bund in the Warsaw Ghetto. You know, this is a man who used his engineering degree to make Molotov cocktails and landmines that blew up German tanks. You know, Mark's grandfather, Henrik, he ran the Bund in Poland. You know, and so I started getting these stories, and I'm like, these are treasures, man. Like these are things that mean that I cannot just drop the Bund like a passing fancy. No, I need to do something with these. And I became obsessed, and I decided to write a book. And the first thing I had to do was learn Yiddish, which was the language of Eastern European Jews. I traveled to Poland, Latvia, Lithuania. I went to Ukraine during the Russian invasion to research this book. And also, I translated countless texts, including like the most boring socialist texts, the things that makes you want to shoot your brains out. They're so boring. And also amazing memoirs. I mean, you talk about how I looked into people's heads. One of the reasons I was able to do that was I chose to foreground people who wrote memoirs. And especially a lot of women wrote these amazing, personal, funny, witty memoirs, like, you know, Patty Kremer's memoir, Sofia Dubnova's memoir. And so I used those, right? Like, it wasn't just me imagining what people might have thought. It was people telling me through letters, through their writings, through their poetry. And, you know, I went back to Palestine in 2023 as a guest of the Palestine Festival of Literature again. I spent the next weeks hanging out on my friend Mariam Barghouti's rooftop and, you know, eating cherries and schnitzel with her and, you know, enjoying the wonderful city of Ramallah. And then I went home and I was prepared to, you know, start a big fellowship at the New York Public Library to write my book. And then fucking October 7th happened and the genocide happened. And, you know, everything changed. And I think that this book it's a book that is deeply shaped and marked by the genocide of Gaza.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, yes, all the more powerful and, I mean, sad for all that. There's a marvelous sequence where I can't remember. There's one of the people who you follow, as it were, is a blonde. I can't remember his name. He's kind of Aryan looking, but Jewish.
Vladimir Medin, the theorist.
I think it's Vladimir. Yeah. But he actually, on his way from, I don't know, it was Paris to Warsaw or somewhere, actually stops off at the founding conference of the Zionist founding conference in, is it Geneva, I think, or somewhere. And it's amazing contrast, I think, partly, you know, because one has been so immersed in the lives of these Bundists of safe houses and meetings and struggle, and then you see Herzl speaking at this first Zionist conference in a casino, and there's a kind of religious hysteria and obviously a great deal of money behind it. And I just think it's a very telling detail, really, I think, of something you don't really, you know, I mean, I never really thought about what the founding conference of Zionism was like, really.
Well, so Medin wasn't actually at the founding conference. In fact, an irony of history was that 1897, which is the year that the Bund is founded by young Marxists with big rap sheets at a secret safe house in Vilna, that's the same year that the World Zionist Organization is founded, and it's at a ritzy casino in Switzerland with all of the world's major media outlets, tons of money behind it, and it's going to turn the founder, Theodor Herzl, into an international superstar. So just that contrast, right? If you think about that, on one hand, all the media, all of the money, the hoopla, right? And the pomp and circumstance around the World Zionist Congress. On the other hand, these young revolutionaries who have nothing except their conviction and their grit and the prospect of a long prison sentence. This is how these two movements form. But Vladimir Medem, right, who is he's a Bundist theorist, but he was actually baptized as a Christian because his parents wanted to save him the burden of all of these anti-Semitic laws in Russia. But he chooses to be a Jew, and he chooses to stand with the dispossessed, you know, voluntarily. So Vladimir Medem, he goes to a later Zionist Congress in 1903. And this Congress is really interesting because at it, Theodor Herzl says something that totally underscores why the Bund and why Zionists hated each other. And what it is that Theodor Herzl is talking about all the deals he's cutting, right, trying to colonize some land in Palestine. And he talks about meeting with this Russian minister of the interior, Vyacheslav von Plev, who is a violent racist who most Jews at the time...
There's a crossover with the Rasputin book there that he features in.
Yeah, Vyacheslav von Plev, you know, hanging with hypnotists and hucksters of all stripes. This is a guy that most Jews, they thought he was responsible for doing the Kishinev pogrom, which is the most, you know, notorious pogrom of the time. He's a racist. And Theodor Herzl is bragging about meeting with him, and he's bragging that... Vyacheslav von Plev is going to help him colonize Palestine. And when Medem sees this, he's like, you're making deals with our murderers, man? And this will be a through line in Zionism. Zionist leaders are always willing to meet and cut deals with poisonously anti-Semitic leaders as long as it can help them advance their goals.
Well, Balfour as well, for instance, yeah.
Exactly.
Author of the famous, another anti-Semite.
Exactly. Mm. Or in interwar Poland, when Zionist leaders were making deals with this viciously anti-Semitic government, a government, by the way, that imposed racial segregation in Polish universities, that was funding terrorist youth paramilitaries, this government, Zionist leaders are making deals so that their militias can be trained. Both the Haganah and the Irgun received, you know, weapons, money, and military training from a government that was murdering Jews in Poland.
Yes, it's. I mean, the ironies in the book and in this history, you know, this history just pile up, don't they? I mean, I'm jumping around really, but I mean the. Communism doesn't come out too well, does it, really?
At least the Russian variety, you know.
I'm a fan of, you know, histories of the Second World War and militarism and all that shit. But I would have liked you to detail what pistols the Bund were being supplied with. I found that that's the one deficiency, I thought. But
Brownings. I mentioned Browning pistols.
Oh yeah, the Browning 1910. Yeah, it's the favorite pistol of all anarchists. Yeah, Picasso had two, and it was the gun that was used to assassinate Archduke Ferdinand.
Really?
This is Alexei's unlikely obsession.
Browning 1910 9mm pistol. Yeah, it's played a massive role in history. But that bit where you get the extraordinary uprising in Warsaw in 1944.
The citywide uprising.
And then fucking Stalin pauses his troops on the Vistula, is it, the other side of the river?
Yeah, in Praga, the suburb that's on the other side. And yeah, because he wants the Polish Home Army and the Nazis to finish each other off and save him the trouble.
Yeah, and so I mean, it's a really interesting critique as well. I think your book of that kind of Marxism Leninism, really rigid, top-down, kind of remorseless, ruthless, cruel, kind of ideological sacrificing of everybody to some kind of vague idea, I guess, of some humanity, some some paradise that will be obtained later. And I think that the, I mean, the bond was, I mean, again, there's a bit, I think there's a very funny bit where I think it's in the Warsaw Ghetto. And, you know, you talk about the many different socialist and Bondist newspapers. And even at that point, you know, being produced under the most phenomenally difficult circumstances, they're still attacking each other.
All of the Jewish leftists in the Warsaw Ghetto are writing newspapers. They are risking being tortured to death to write newspapers so they can say that other Jewish leftist groups in the Warsaw Ghetto don't understand dialectical materialism.
Exactly. I mean, it's both, obviously, it's very funny, but also a poignant point, really. But, I mean, how would you typify the ideology of the Bund? I mean,
the Bund were a socialist, a democratic socialist, secular, but defiantly Jewish political party. Originally, they did not imagine being a separate political party. They wanted to be an organization inside of a larger party that would liberate all of, you know, Tsarist Russia. And it's interesting because I think in 2026, it's a little hard for some people maybe to understand, what do you mean when you say that they were a defiantly Jewish but secular party, right? And it's because Jews in the Tsarist Empire were a racialized minority. It didn't matter if you were a Jewish atheist, still said Jew on your passport, still determined where you lived, still determined, you know, whether you were allowed to go to school, what jobs you could have. At one point, it meant that your military term was 25 years, not 5 years, like for a Christian. And being a Jew was seen by everyone there as an ethnic identity. And also, you know, Jews spoke a different language by and large. They spoke Yiddish. And so these young, you know, young Marxists who founded the Bund, they both wanted to like overthrow the Tsar, bring about the, you know, democratic socialist utopia, but also they wanted the dignity and liberation of their own people. They wanted an end to the racist laws. They wanted an end to the quotidian bigotry and violence. And they wanted their people to have the right to, should they choose to, express their culture, you know, with theater, with literature, with poetry, with song, with all of the support that, you know, French culture or German culture or Russian culture would get, you know, that any other language of state and empire would get. And, you know, when I think about them, they really remind me the most of the Black Panther Party in the U.S., which was also, you know, a party of a racialized group of young Marxists that both spoke of international solidarity and solidarity across difference, but also fought relentlessly for their own oppressed culture, for their own communities.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's one of the trends that we're starting to see here, revived is that what the Black Panthers did and what the Muslim Brotherhood did and what the Bund did, which is also not just to organize for votes in the bourgeois democracy, but also to organize breakfast clubs and legal advice and, you know, just ancillary support for your community, I think, you know, which is both politically astute but also kind of morally just better, really, you know.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
I think it yeah.
And I mean, we see that with democratic socialists in America. I've been a DSA member for 10 years.
Yes, you're going to save us all, I think. It's
oh, dear God.
it's all terribly exciting, I think, really. We have the occasional, we had the brief excitement over the Green Party, but that's kind of gone backwards slightly over here. But I think that it is tremendously exciting to see that, you know, there's obviously with Zara Mandali, but Brad Lander and the two women being winning the primaries. And I used to pay no interest in U.S. politics, but it does seem like at least, you know, that, I mean, the U.S., United States being the hegemon that finances this evil.
Exactly. And also, I mean, the thing that has doomed so many socialist projects around the world, whether it's simply done coups against them, like against Allende, or whether it's forced socialist governments to adopt a paranoia because they're constantly under attack.
Exactly,
it's been the U.S. And so I think that if we actually can change things, if we actually can take control, at least of major cities, I mean, we can change the world from here. And, you know, it's not just in New York. We got the mayorship of DC recently, and we just got in a new congresswoman from Colorado, a woman who was thrown out of her job for supporting Palestine. Now she's a congresswoman. She beat a congressman who had been in office as long as she was alive. And and you know, when I think about DSA, so you know, I've been there for 10 years, right? I have seen the birth of the DSA electoral program. I remember our first state senator we got in. And it's not just that the DSA built a really, really sophisticated electoral machine that's like really good at door knocking, though we did. It's that DSA in New York, it has a culture. It has soccer leagues. It has dances. It has dating. It has political education, but it also has like fun. And those sort of, that sort of culture, right? Places where people make friends, where they fall in love, where they get married. That's the thing that makes you more than like fellow volunteers during an electoral campaign, right? That's what makes you actual comrades.
Right. I think that's such a profound thing to say, really, because it's the only way it's going to work, isn't it? Not with that. I've got a book coming out, and Weber, the kind of the inventor of social democracy, he's famously quoted as saying, you know, politics is the slow boring through hard wood.
Yes.
I think, well, fuck that. You know? He wants to fucking spend their evenings slow boring through hard wood. But I mean, that's the kind of thinking that attracts the kind of soul dead people who become conventional politicians, establishment politicians, is that they are perfectly happy spending their evenings slow boring through hardwood. But what it needs to be is much more joyful. Yeah. Our political organization, I think. Yeah.
And welcoming to all sorts of people, like whether those people are like gym bros who want to lift weights, whether those people are nerds, whether those people are theater kids, whether they're like very conservative, you know, religious people, or whether they're like wild bohemians, because we're trying to build politics for the working class. And the working class is the broadest group in the world. It includes all sorts of people.
Yes, everybody. Yeah. I mean, to kind of spool back again, the Bund, I mean, your book, in a way, is also a depressing cancer through human nature, in a sense, really.
I mean, it's the story of history in the first half of the 20th century, the most depressing.
Yeah. I got up to World War II, and I had to take a couple of days off because I just thought, this is so fucking grim, really. I mean, the Bund tried to make alliances with Goyisher socialist parties, and was often rejected, really, weren't they? I think the Polish socialists come out of it reasonably well. I mean, one of the things that it's just life was so, must have been so horrible in those fucking towns and villages in the Ukraine and Poland, and you know, people were at their most bestial, I think.
It's true. So there are points at which, you know, the Bund is trying to work with Goyisha parties, and I mean, one part that really gutted me was when Bundists are trying to work with the Rada, the government of, you know, early independent Ukraine, and the Rada is, you know, it's run at first by humanistic socialist people. One of its two leaders has a Jewish wife. It's not that; it's that they have no control over their own armed forces, and the volcanic violence and hallucinatory bigotry, not just of, you know, the government allied forces, but of all sorts of rampaging bands of murderers going through Ukraine, is such that it destroys any possibility of the Bund being part of the Rada, and eventually forces these Bundists to, you know, to ally with the Red Army. I mean, that for me was one of the bleakest moments. The moment that broke my heart was, of many, obviously this book broke my heart, but the moment that I kept coming back to was, I had come into the book thinking that the Polish Socialist Party had betrayed the Bund during World War II. That was just sort of a vague impression that I got. And then as I did research, I realized that wasn't true. I realized that Polish socialists had gone to Auschwitz for distributing the Bund's press, that they had hid Bundist children in their homes. They had hid Bundists in their homes at risk to the lives of their whole family. They taught them how to make bombs. They had gotten them fake papers. They'd kept them alive. So I was like, what is it? What is it? Why do I have this memory that there was a betrayal when, as I read these memoirs, I don't see a betrayal. In fact, I see like real comradeship. What is it? And what it was that when the Jewish young leftist groups formed the Jewish Combat Organization in the ghetto, and when they decided to launch the uprising, the Polish Home Army, including the Polish socialists, would not join in. And the reason that they wouldn't join in was because, by their calculation, if the rebellion spread to the Aryan city, America hadn't landed in Europe, Russia was still tied up in Stalingrad, no one would save them and everyone would be killed. And so they had made a sort of an impossible, cruel, horrific, but also in some ways, they had made a horrific calculation that I think made sense to them at the time, which was that the people in the ghetto were doomed and the people outside of the ghetto were not. And so they would continue their military plan to wait to do an uprising until some force would be close enough to relieve them. And the ghetto burned in the center of the city. And, you know, these Polish socialists, they watched people who were their friends, their lovers, their comrades, their cellmates, they watched them incinerated in the center of Warsaw. And they did not do an uprising on the other side of the wall. And I think that that's really the moment that reveals this hard limit to solidarity. And that was certainly the moment that broke me. And I think one of the great ironies, right, is something that you brought up later, which was that, you know, a year after the ghetto was destroyed, the Russians got to the other side of the Vistula and made radio broadcasts calling on the Polish population to rebel against the Nazis. And the Polish population did. And then the Russians just watched while the Nazis killed them all and destroyed Warsaw. So yeah, this book, in some ways, there's some of the most beautiful, inspiring moments of like the political, the leftist, or the human spirit. But in a lot of other ways, this book was like a fucking dagger in my heart that kept twisting over and over again to write.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's certainly, there's no greater condemnation, again, of that kind of Marxist-Leninist communism than, you know, you say, well, the Soviet Union was, you know, the Soviet Union was this, Soviet Union, but I mean, that kind of cynical cruelty, you know, they could have, and then they could have killed everybody afterwards, or if they wanted, or, you know, what I mean, but to just, I mean, I suppose in a sense Stalin was a monster, but Stalin was only the symptom of his whole sick society and ideology, wasn't he, really? So, I mean, it's such a depressing. And also, of course, the when the Russians in the Hitler-Ribbentrop-Stalin pact, when the Russians take half of Poland, the eastern half of Poland, and they, I mean, again, that's, the way it's the there's a couple of the Bundists you mentioned are taken to Moscow and put up in the Metropole Hotel and in great luxury and then are murdered. And
the two leaders of the Bund in Poland are immediately arrested by the Soviets in eastern Poland, where they had fled to try to, you know, set up some sort of anti-Hitler resistance. They're immediately arrested. They're kept in jail, you know, interrogated, force-fed, you know, condemned to death. And then when Hitler breaks this pact with Stalin, and when the Soviet Union begins to lose incredibly badly to the point that the Red Army is pushed back to the suburbs of Moscow, at that point, Stalin releases these two men from jail and says, why don't you help us get America involved in the war? You have influence. You know American Jewish labor leaders. And then puts them up in great luxury, asks them to found this thing called the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee. And then as soon as it becomes clear that America is going to join the war, they arrest them. And Victor Alter, one of the two leaders, is shot. And Henrik Ehrlich, the other leader, hangs himself in his cell.
Yeah. The fucking left.
The fucking left, man.
I know, makes you despair. So, I mean, what do you think of the future? So, what's the reaction been to your book? First of all, I think I've seen a lot of praise. You feel like it's made a difference, really.
Well, so the book in America debuted at number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list. And this is not something I think anyone would have expected for a 400 and some odd page book on leftist Jewish history in Poland. But I think that speaks to this intense hunger people have. And it's not just that. I did a 27-stop book tour, and I toured all over the US, and I did 3 London events, and I did 2 events in Paris as well. And these events were fucking packed. These events were just jammed. And it was really interesting sometimes looking at the ages of people, because I feel like, you know, while we have all sorts of ages and while, you know, there's Jewish people, lots of non-Jewish people too at my events. But if I was going to like make just a blanket statement about the ages of the Jewish people there, it's on one hand, hot 19-year-old girls in mini skirts and L'chaim Intifada t-shirts and keffiyehs. And then the other hand, you know, people sometimes in their 70s or 80s or 90s who tell me about how they were communists. One woman, she wrote about how their father robbed banks to fund the revolution back in Belarus, about, you know, their participation with SDS or civil rights. One woman, she, an amazing woman, she wrote me a letter about how her grandfather was in the Bund. He was murdered in Erie, Pennsylvania, a rust belt, old steel town in Pennsylvania, for being a socialist. And how she, this woman, a lifelong Marxist, at 39 years old, became a coal miner in Pennsylvania so that she could organize coal miners. And she worked 13 years as a coal miner organizing. And, you know, she's an elderly woman now, and she, you know, carries this flame in her, and she's an anti-Zionist as well. And I think that especially Jewish leftists across generations are finding each other, and they're finding this history that has been so deliberately erased. I mean, I'm doing these signing lines, and, you know, I'm signing like hundreds and hundreds of books, and people are crying. They're talking about their parents. They're talking about their grandparents. They're talking about a history they never knew. They're saying that my book gave them their ancestors back. And I also think that there's something else too in America where, you know, most Americans, you know, most people in the world, they've never met a Jewish person. We're a very small group, you know. And this state that's doing a genocide, it purports to speak in our name. It justifies its horrific actions by invoking our identity, our history. And I think that most people, they don't want to think of Jewish people that way. You know, they don't want to stereotype any group that way. And so when they learn about this history of Jews on the left and this history of Jews fighting for not merely their own liberation, but the liberation of everyone, I think it's something very powerful for all sorts of people. I had an amazing launch in London. I was with Palestine Festival of Literature. It was me and this brilliant Palestinian translator, Hazem Jamjoum. He's Hassan Kanafani's translator. And it was packed. It was, you know, hundreds of people at South Bank Center. And I just think that speaks to the immense hunger people have.
Yes, absolutely. It is. Yeah. I mean, it's a sort of, it feels sometimes like a kind of a race, though, doesn't it, between we've got, you know, I don't know how well you know our politics. We've got this Labour government here, which is so authoritarian, so in the grip of the Israeli arms industry and the Israel lobby, and, you know, shockingly is moving at the moment to criminalise really, you know, any kind of, you know, debanking.
Jesus.
left-wing publications, and yeah, moving to criminalize really any contact with what they deem foreign groups, and of course the whole Palestine action. I don't know if you know the cruel and brutal treatment of Palestine action, and also the barrister for Palestine Action, Menon, is being apparently charged because he implied in his speech that he was speaking for the Palestine Action, the Fulton Six, that he might have implied that the courts were biased.
I was watching these videos of like these elderly, like these grandmas being dragged off because they're holding a sign that says, I oppose genocide. I support Palestine Action. And also one thing that was very surreal for me was I was in the UK and then they wouldn't allow Hassan Piker into the UK. Hassan Piker. Yeah. Hassan Piker is an anti-fascist. Hassan Piker is on every single, you know, Jewish lefty podcast. He promoted my book, man. He's fighting against anti-Semitism and all forms of racism, you know, and these people fucking banned him. What the hell, man?
I know. It was like a reflex. I mean, it's also a kind of just a sop to the Israel lobby, really. They just, you know, it didn't get much coverage. I mean, that we got a bit of coverage here, but not enough, really. But, you know, it just sees how they reflexively do stuff that they think will please the, I don't know whether the Israel lobby asked them to do it, but, you know, Hassan and also Cenk, of course, that they just kind of do it anyway. It's really dangerous, this government, particularly our Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood. So it's a kind of race between that, I think, that impulse for people for a more just world and these fucking bought and paid for political robots, really. I mean, I don't know. How do you think that'll go?
So, I think that I can speak better about the US context. I have to admit, sometimes when I read UK stuff, I'm baffled. Like you have a fucking board of Jewish deputies? Who fucking elected them? Like it's very
nobody.
Yeah, there's a chief rabbi that no one elected. It's very strange. It reminds me of like it's very like colonial or something. But anyway, each of our countries is batshit in its special way. But the thing I will say about America is I think that the uncritical support of Israel, it's over in America. I think that the thing that's scary is that currently we have these like real right-wing fascists, right? These people who are all in on the deportation of immigrants. They're all in on the concentration camp infrastructure. They're all in on making life miserable for trans and gay people. But they're blaming the failures of MAGA on Israel. And there's, you know, it's very famously, there is a rising, like, hard right anti-Israel movement. And okay, it's good that they're anti-Israel, but these people support putting immigrants in concentration camps. You know, that ought to be a hard line too. So there's that. But then also there's, you know, the movement that's represented by the DSA and allied people that's winning. And I think that no matter who we get, whether we get a right-wing fash scumbag as our next president, or whether we get a Democratic politician with some decency to him, whatever we get, they're not going to be an uncritical supporter of Israel. That's over in America. Voters are completely rejecting that. And without that uncritical support, Israel is in a far, far weaker position than it is now, because it's a tiny, tiny little country that is dependent on the US and on other, you know, external actors. It cannot pursue its policy of starting lunatic wars with all of its neighbors without being supported by empire.
Yes, I agree. I think it's very exciting what's happening in the United States, really. And I don't think we're there yet in Britain in a way. And yes, we have to. I mean, our ludicrous and archaic aspects of our own culture the beef eaters of the Tower of London have to rise up. Support. Once the beef eaters are crying freedom for Palestine, we'll know. Yeah, but I think it's, you know, I mean, your book is, I mean, it's, I mean, again, you do just, I mean, the extraordinary cruelty of those people that, you know, yours and my grandparents fled from, in a way that, I guess, you know, the savagery of life in 19th century Europe. But, as you say, there are many, many knives to the heart in your book, in a sense. But ultimately, I think there is a message of hope, I think. I hope.
Absolutely. I mean, the Bund were a group that believed in human solidarity across difference. They believed in democratic socialism. They believed in the better and more beautiful world. And that is the only thing that can save us right now. We have to unite across categories of identity for a working class politics that fights for all of us. Because, like, Jesus, right now, when I look at the forces arrayed against us, when I look at these, like, these soulless billionaires who are trying to suck up all the resources of the earth and human culture into their, like, fucking AI slot machines, when I look at the concentration of wealth and power, like, my God, we have to fucking unite against that.
Yeah. Well, let's hope we do. I must say to all our listeners, this is a tremendous book that you should buy. I bought with my own money. Here's Where We Live Is Our Country by Molly Crabapple. I think it's an original. It's an amazing piece of work in and of itself, in its kind of artistic daring, but it's also a fantastic evocation of a kind of suppressed history, really. So
I'll put a link of an ethical place to buy it in our description, in the podcast description, YouTube description. I'll also put a link to our Patreon, patreon.com/ Alexis Sale podcast, where you can support the show just for a few quid a month. Alexis Sale, patreon.com/ Alexis Sale podcast. Please go on there. You can see full video episodes. You'll get the podcast a bit early and lots of other extra bits we do. Molly, I just need to compliment your artwork. You've got really expressive, beautiful kind of water paint style with this kind of gothic, haunted kind of tinge to it. It's really beautiful. And it adorns the front covers of your books, right? Those are all your own.
Yes, it's all my own work.
Paintings. And I noticed you've done some work on Syria as well. My heritage is Syrian.
Oh, wow. Which city are you from?
London.
I
know. Mum's from Damascus and dad's from Latakia.
One of the most beautiful cities on earth. Your parents are from, your mum is from.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the oldest as well. And you did a series of illustrated articles during the ISIS years and all that, and the book Brothers of the Gun. I just wanted to ask if you're keeping up with Syria and what do you think of kind of where they're at the moment? If you have any thoughts on,
man, I mean,
it's a topic that comes up every now and then on the show.
I mean, you know, I am, you know, like many of my friends are Syrian. My co-author Marwan, who I did the book with, he moved back to Raqqa after ISIS was kicked out. He's working on a novel, and I mean, I'm just happy that there's no longer a hereditary dictatorship, and for everything that the new government has, or people allied with it, have done that is fucked and horrific. And, you know, your family is from Latakia, you know, the fucking horrific coastal massacre that was done by government allied forces. I am happy that at least there's space that people can criticize the government. But at the end of the day, I mean, I'm an American, and it's not my country, you know, it's Syrians. And I'm just so happy that they can actually have a stab at defining their own future outside of a hereditary dictatorship. And also fuck Israel for trying to steal land and making life miserable in the areas that they are attempting to annex. I've been reading a lot about just like Israeli incursions and just like making life hell for these people in these villages who are just like trying to rebuild their lives after this evil fucking civil war.
Yeah, it's quite bittersweet, isn't it? I think we've taken enough of your time, right? Apart from the book, is there anything else you want to let our listeners know about, Molly?
No, just the book. And also, I always tell people that the Bund loved nothing more than explaining why they were right and other people were wrong. And I'm sure many of the listeners of this show have people in their lives who are wrong. Buy them a copy of my book. And maybe they'll start becoming right.
I endorse this message. All right. Well, Molly, thank you very much for giving us your time today. And bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.